Hello. This time on Sit Rep, is this Russian roulette or chess? We have some big questions to answer about Ukraine's military push into its enemy's sovereign territory.
Цілком справедливо знищувати.
It is entirely justified to destroy Russian terrorists wherever they are, wherever they launch their attacks from. Russia needs to be forced into peace.
That's President Zelensky's take on why. Simon Newton joins us to explain how. And Mike, as usual, gets the hard job working out what comes next. Also on SITREP, 75 years since the Geneva Conventions came into force, setting limits on the conduct of war. Do those conventions now need a rethink? And the moment that made George Cross holder Kim Hughes.
This guy was putting his life on the line to return the situation to normal in West Belfast at that time. I wanted to be that guy, and I wanted to put that bomber's bowman suit on and step away from my career as a driver.
SITREP with James Hurst and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, this has certainly been a plot twist in the war between Russia and Ukraine. I don't think I saw it possibly as coming even as an idea, Mike. It's certainly looking right now as a big psychological win at this point for Ukraine.
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, they've got some real political benefit out of it, although the military benefit is still to be realized. And, you know, putting this into perspective, we all know that these counterpunches are very risky with very high rewards, but very high costs if they go wrong. And just to give it a historical parallel, I was thinking of three cases, very briefly, just a word. The most successful I can think of a counterpunch like this was the Incheon landings in the Korean War in 1950, when Douglas MacArthur landed at Incheon right behind the North Koreans, who were pressing all the way down the peninsula, cut off their supplies, and within weeks completely reversed the North Korean offensive. So that was brilliantly successful. Another example would be the Israelis in 1973. They were under real pressure with this attack from Egypt, and they crossed the Suez Canal and got behind the Egyptian Third Army. Now, that didn't completely reverse the initiative, but it created a stalemate, and out of that came a ceasefire. And then the great example of the one that failed was Robert E. Lee in the American Civil War, the Gettysburg Campaign. In order to take pressure off his troops in Virginia, he made this brilliant push through the Shenandoah Valley, through Maryland, into Pennsylvania, to get right behind the Union troops. And they met him at Gettysburg in a three-day battle, which he lost, and that was a complete failure. And after that, after Gettysburg, there was no way back for the Confederacy. They'd lost the war. It took time for that to be realized, but they'd lost the war. So you can see in these examples, you know, Incheon was brilliant. Gettysburg was a heroic failure. You know, when they go wrong, they go wrong in a pretty big way. So we shouldn't have any doubt about this. This is a surprise move. It's not as big as those that I've just mentioned, but my goodness, it is pushing the boundaries.
Okay, well, there's a lot of questions to dig into, and that is why Simon Newton is with us once again, expert on all things Ukraine for SITREP and BFBS Forces News. Can you explain how Ukraine did this? Because it's no mean feat, is it?
No, as Mike said, it's a big event, and I think the first thing to say, just one caveat, is a lot of this is conjecture, because there is this policy of silence from the Ukrainian side. A lot of the information we're getting is from the Russian side of things, but there seems to have been a kind of coming together of a lot of different tactics, a lot of things that they've learned, the Ukrainians, particularly from the counteroffensive last summer, in terms of concealment. You know, we heard that some of the soldiers involved in this, that even they didn't know what they were about to embark upon. There was this belief that perhaps Gerasimov, the chief of staff of Russia, was warned this was going to happen, but actually ignored those warnings. So that gave a window of opportunity. The raids that we saw earlier in the year into Belgorod by these Russian volunteers who fight for Ukraine, they now possibly on reflection look as if they were kind of dry runs to see what the Russian reaction would be, whether they would reinforce these areas of the front line significantly, which they didn't. Drone warfare has advanced. The Ukrainians have been able to take out some of these Orlan 10 reconnaissance drones that the Russians use to kind of blind the Russian commanders on the ground, stop them putting artillery onto their positions. They've also used electronic warfare effectively. We understand, found the Russian frequencies along that front line. They've been able to effectively switch them off. And the other big factor here, Mike would agree, is just the speed at which they've gone through. They've used lighter vehicles. They haven't stopped and dug in like they did on this, on the counteroffensive. They just kept going. And that's not allowed the Russians to counterattack significantly. So it's a coming together of lots of little clever, very clever military tactics that they've put in place. And obviously the big help here was this section of the border. They picked it very cleverly because it was just guarded by, you know, a thin layer, if you like, of these Russian conscripts.
You mentioned that they pushed through in a lot of light vehicles. Have they taken in much heavy armor as well?
They have been taking in tanks. We've seen some Polish PT-91, I think they are, tanks in there. And we've seen reports today that possibly even a Challenger has been spotted inside Russia itself, which would be definitely a first. But most of the time it has been these lighter vehicles, these Strykers, these MRAPs, which have allowed them just to punch out very quickly to these parts of Kursk and just push this bulge further and further out.
Mike, what to you looks like the ground strategy that Ukraine is taking here? I mean, is there a ground strategy, or is it simply taking advantage of a window of opportunity?
No, I do think there has to be a ground strategy behind it. Otherwise, it's only political, it's only gesture politics. I mean, it's certainly having some big effect there. But unless they can keep the Russians unbalanced in some way, then there isn't there's no strategic benefit. Now, they are keeping the Russians unbalanced all the way along the frontier. So that, you know, the whole land frontier between Ukraine and Russia is about 2,000 kilometers, about 1,200 miles. And there are five oblasts, five regions that border between the two countries. And three of those regions are in a state of some upset now. So Bryansk, Kursk itself, and Belgorod, further south, are all, two of them are under a state of emergency. All three of them are under counter-terrorist measures. And about 180,000 people seem to be on the move, being evacuated. So the Ukrainians are having some effect in making the border feel insecure. And that's part of the idea. But ultimately, this move will only be judged a success by military analysts if it has the effect of relieving pressure elsewhere on the Ukrainians. And so far, there's a little bit of evidence of that, but not where they really want the pressure to be eased, in the Donbass. So the Russians are still pushing even harder than they were last week for Pokrovsk. They're pushing even harder for Chasiv Yar and up towards, they hope, Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. So, unless the Ukrainians can feel that the pressure there is easing, then this effect, this counterpunch, will be seen as not achieving its purpose as a military tactic.
And when you talk about that huge border, how much of that border is it that Ukraine has crossed and taken control of right now, Mike?
About 25 miles. So about 25 miles out of 1,200 miles. It's tiny. It's an enclave in terms of the amount of border. But either side of that, you've got literally, 100 miles either side, which is now insecure. And they're moving troops and they're digging more fortifications, another sort of 45 kilometers behind their border. So it's upset them because it's made it clear that whole border, a couple of hundred miles across that central span of border, you know, north and south of Kursk, has to be regarded as insecure.
So, Simon, Mike says this will be judged as real military success if it relieves pressure on Ukraine's forces in Ukraine. Do we have any idea of what forces Russia is moving in response to this right now?
Well, again, this is information we're gathering from sort of online sources and things. We understand that, as Mike says, that they're not taking a huge number of forces away from these fronts, these battles around Pokrovsk, from Chasiv Yar, from Turetsk, these areas of the Donbass that they're trying to push through. They are effectively taking some of the soldiers that would have been sent there to rotate in and out. They're just redirecting them to Kursk, we understand. So there are some just talk of some conscripts being sent as well. There obviously were conscripts there already, but Russian conscripts aren't supposed to be in combat, I think, until they serve for about 4 months. But there's some talk about them sending some very green conscripts into this battle. They're also are sending some good units, though. There's reports of them sending VDV paratroopers, some of their naval infantry, that the Russian Marines from the 80th Naval Infantry Brigade also going. And some of the artillery units, even from Kaliningrad, this enclave south of Lithuania. So they're pulling them in from all different places, possibly around nine brigades, I've read, of Russian troops or elements of are being sent into this fight. And as Mike said, they're digging this, there's evidence they're digging this trench network about 45 kilometers inside Russia now to kind of almost turn this into a positional battle if it happens to grind to a halt at that point.
And as you say, I mean, we're having to work on insights really from open source intelligence, but do we have any sense of how big and capable the Ukrainian force currently in the Kursk region is, and whether Ukraine is also reinforcing that at this point?
Well, they have the issue that they are taking troops from those areas, from Chasivyar, from the other battles that are taking place. So they have this balancing act to do, but they are taking that. They understand there's possibly elements of, again, six or so brigades of Ukrainian troops involved in this, between 10 and 15,000 troops. Might have a different figure, but that's what I've read. So there's some very capable air assault brigades, the 80th, the 82nd and the 95th involved in this, and a couple of mechanized brigades as well. And as I said earlier, they've taken a lot of Western kit with them, Stryker, armored fighting vehicles, MRAPs, German Marders. We've seen this sighting possibly of a Challenger involved. And controversially, perhaps they, you know, we've had these HIMARS strikes inside Russia, which has been, you know, strictly speaking, the Americans say they can only use those and the MRLS for sort of defensive operations. But the Washington's kind of turned a blind eye to that, saying this is a defensive battle. So they have taken... Yeah, I say we believe about 15,000 Ukrainian troops involved, something around that sort of magnitude.
I mean, Mike, let's just talk briefly about the Western response. Ukraine's Western backers seem to be, at least publicly, saying go ahead right now.
Yeah, they have to say that. I mean, they're sounding all very relaxed, but I can promise you they're quite queasy about this, because the image of Western armored vehicles inside Russia is something they would have wanted to avoid. But the fact is, they can't gainsay the fact that the Ukrainians have got a right to defend their borders, and that requires going after the Russians close to the border.
But
it's all a question
of
depth.
You and I would have had a conversation back in February 2020, because we're trying to get my years here, February 2022, where we probably would have said if you saw a single Western vehicle in Russia, that would be war with NATO.
Well, we've also said, yeah, James, I mean, going back to then, that this crisis, you and I both agreed, this crisis will get more dangerous as it goes on. And we've seen in threshold after threshold being crossed. And every time a threshold is crossed, you know, we're not going to give the Ukrainians HIMARS, long-range multiple-launch rockets, and then we do. We're not going to give them tanks, and then we do. We're not going to give them aircraft, and then we do. We cross every threshold after saying we won't. And every time we cross a threshold, the Russians threaten everything. They threaten World War III, and they never do anything else because the Russians are already doing their worst. And in a way, the deterrent effect of Russian rhetoric is wearing off all the time. And so I think that, you know, we the West are still very nervous of the idea that Western weapons are used for deep strikes into Russia, but Western weapons on the frontier area, we can live with. We're not entirely happy about it, but we recognize, I think, or our governments recognize, there is a strict military logic to this. And I suspect that the ban on deep strike weapons, Western deep strike weapons like Storm Shadow and Atacms, I think that will probably wear off as well in time.
Okay, so the big question, where does this go next? How long is Ukraine going to have troops in this region, and what is their end game, do you think, Mike?
Well, what happens next is the Battle of Kursk, the second Battle of Kursk. It hasn't really begun yet. I mean, this is all positional stuff, and this is maneuvering. And as Simon was saying, we can see the way forces are building up on both sides, and the battle is about to be joined. How long it lasts will be an interesting question. I don't think it'll last that long. I keep saying I think this battle will be measured in days and weeks, rather than weeks and months. I don't think it can last very long, because the Russians cannot live with the idea that a piece of their territory has been invaded like this. And in a way, the Ukrainians are goading the Russians to come and get them. I mean, they're establishing humanitarian aid corridors. They're behaving like an occupying power, a very civilized occupying power. They want to make that point. And they're putting down, as it were, markers within the territory. They say, well, we don't want to invade Russia, but we're staying here for a while. And that's goading the Russians to actually throw them out. And I think what they want to do is create this Battle of Kursk as a way of relieving pressure elsewhere. That's where it becomes dangerous, because they might lose the Battle of Kursk before they can withdraw in good order and still lose ground in Pokrovsk and Chasiv-Yar and so on. If that's the case, then the whole thing will have been a disaster. But if they can hold their own for, let's say, a month or 6 weeks and get some relief down in the south, then they get to the winter and they're in a better position than they were during the summer.
And Simon, if we just go finally back to the tactical level to an extent, I mean, on the face of it, there is a strong argument for going into Kursk to take out some of Russia's military capability. How much effect are they having in terms of that right now?
Well, I mean, we've had drone strikes, obviously, haven't we, on Russian airfields, and we've had the downing of this Su-34 and various things. So I don't think, and we do see, because all the video we're seeing online is of Ukrainian armor being destroyed, far more than we're seeing the other way around. We don't necessarily know how much impact it's having on the Russian forces in that area. And I don't think the big battles of Kursk haven't actually happened yet. We're sort of heading towards that. So they are bringing in more soldiers. We are going to work towards, you know, this bigger battle. So I think for the Ukrainians, obviously, this is a very difficult gamble, because they are taking troops from elsewhere that they need, and manpower is their biggest issue and has been for some time now. And it isn't an issue for the Russians necessarily. They hit their recruitment goals. They have got conscripts. They've got contract soldiers they can put in, and they don't mind losing huge numbers of them. So in terms of attrition, I think we'll find out the answer to that question, you know, in the coming weeks, I suppose.
I mean, we've been talking about the war as a whole for 2.5 years. So inevitably, we're going to be talking about the battle for Kursk for at least some weeks. Simon, thank you very much indeed. Now, in the war between Ukraine and Russia, troops on both sides have equal responsibilities and rights. But should they have that equality, given that it is Russia that chose this fight and Ukraine did not? The Geneva Conventions, which lay out these laws of war, have just reached their 75th anniversary, but much has changed in that time, and some believe the conventions need to change too, 75 years on. Every country in the world is signed up to them, but all too often we are seeing the rules being broken. Well, I've been talking to David Rodin. He's a regular lecturer in ethics to senior officers at the UK's Joint Services Command and Staff College. He's also co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict. He's been telling me why he believes the current conventions effectively give permission for wars of aggression, and why he thinks that should change.
At the very core of the Geneva Conventions is this idea that there is a what you might call a moral or legal equality between combatants. So no matter whether you are serving on the just side of a war, defending your state against aggression, or the unjust side of the war, if you're an aggressive soldier, no matter which side you're fighting on, the law will give you the same set of obligations, but also the same set of permissions. So it will say to you, on either side, you are permitted to use force against enemy combatants. Now, from a moral perspective, that seems really problematic, right? So, you know, take the example of Russia and Ukraine. A Russian combatant who is fighting in Ukraine, let's say it's a combatant who wants to, you know, respect the Geneva Conventions. Not all of them do. Many of them do not. But let's say it's a Russian combatant who wants to respect the conventions, so does not target Ukrainian civilians, only Ukrainian military personnel. Now, according to the Geneva Conventions, as they're currently interpreted, that's completely fine. So it creates the permission to target those just enemy combatants. But from a deeper moral perspective, you could say, well, that just seems completely wrong. It gives the permission to kill people who are doing nothing more than rightly and properly and appropriately defending their homeland. So from a kind of moral perspective, you could say it's creating a widespread legal permission to create something that looks a lot like unjust killing or murder.
Essentially, if you take that argument to what might seem an extreme but logical conclusion, you're then asking to outlaw war, and probably no state is going to do that, to sign up
well,
to that.
Well, not necessarily. So what you would be doing is you would be saying that at the level of combatants, at the level of soldiers, not only of commanders and statesmen, that there is really an obligation not to engage in aggressive war. And remember, the prohibition of aggression is really the fundamental touchstone of all of the laws of war. I mean, it is really the fundamental core and basis. So what you would be saying is essentially soldiers, ordinary combatants, have to be thinking about not only targeting the right group, so, you know, so avoiding targeting civilians, but also they would have to reflect on, is this actually a permissible war? Is it a war of self-defense? Is it a war perhaps of humanitarian protection? And it would be saying, if it's a war of aggression, then there is an obligation on you as an individual soldier not to participate in it. So that's different from saying that you're outlawing war in general, because it would still provide a permission to engage in those appropriate wars. But it would just be saying, you know, hey, soldiers, look, you can't, you don't just get a free pass just because you are attacking enemy soldiers. It matters what kind of soldiers they are, whether it's an aggressive war or a defensive war.
When people sign up to a military, that they sign up to accept orders, there's only so much you can do as an ordinary member of an armed force to shape the decisions that are taken above you, Kent, isn't there?
So that's right, and that's clearly a very important part of how we think about the kind of contract for soldiers. But remember that there is already an obligation on soldiers to not obey and not follow what lawyers describe as manifestly unlawful orders. So, you know, if your commander tells you to go and shoot, you know, a group of civilians in a village, it is your obligation as a soldier to not obey that order. And you can face legal penalties and prosecutions if you follow a manifestly unlawful order.
We have seen a lot of concern in the UK about lawfare, legal action against troops for actions in the line of duty. If troops have to consider whether the actions of their governments are legal, it would seem, if that were to go ahead, it would seem impossible to have a functioning military if that was how deep the legal responsibility for the decision to go to war could be prosecuted.
Yeah, so it would certainly be a concern, but remember also that's not an old concern. I mean, these concerns were raised essentially at every point at which the laws of war were developed. They were raised about the original Geneva Conventions in 1949. It was raised around the additional protocols in 1977 that hugely expanded the scope of the Geneva Convention. So it's an old worry, and it's a worry that's been raised at every point at which the laws of war have been expanded. Now, that's not to say that it's a false worry, and there's no problem there. But it does suggest that there are ways that we can find an accommodation, and forces have found a way to fight effectively within, you know, within those legal constructs and legal constraints. I think, you know, this kind of provision would be much, much deeper, but there are also precedents for this. So in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, there was in the UK, you know, what came to be called the Revolt of the Generals, which is essentially senior commanders saying to Tony Blair at the time, you know, listen, we need to have a legal guarantee, or at least some kind of a legal assessment that tells us that this is a lawful operation to undertake. And that was what pushed Tony Blair into bringing the Attorney General in to give the assessment. So there are precedents for this. You know, expanding that, you know, beyond down into the serving personnel would expand that in a much more significant way. But, you know, I think there are certainly a lot of people who say, you know, that would be to the good. It would create an additional constraint, an additional kind of reflection that would be required before military force is fielded. And potentially it may protect us against, you know, what turned out to be very foolish and very damaging deployments of military personnel, Iraq being a wonderful example of that.
There's a great saying you hear a lot in military circles, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And ultimately, the aim of the Geneva Conventions was not to stop war, but to set limits on it to minimize that, because that was a realistic and effective goal. What you're talking about seems to argue for extending the reach of Geneva Conventions, not just to regulate the conduct of wars, but to regulate whether or not wars happen, and that could ultimately lead to the whole system unraveling if people aren't prepared to sign up to it.
Mm. So, look, it's a great question, and it is a really, really important point. But I think, you know, one of the key things that you need to think about when we think about international law is that it's a project, right? So it is a set of provisions that have developed hugely over many, many centuries. It's been a slow project, and it's been an uncertain project, and there's been a project that's had many reversals. But the direction of travel has been unmistakable, and I think the benefits of that project have also been unmistakable. So at every, you know, at every moment of that, we have to reflect, you know, are we going too fast? Are we actually, you know, risking damage to the whole structure by pushing too far and too fast? I think it's a valid question. I think it's a legitimate question. But I think what's not legitimate is to say, you know, look, we, you know, it stops, it freezes. Because I don't think anybody looks at the laws of war and says, this is in the perfect form or it's in the best form that it could be in.
David Rodin from the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict. I mean, there is a clear case set out there for a moral logic in this. But I guess one of the many potential problems is one man's war of aggression is another man's war of liberation.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not that there is no international law in relation to wars of aggression. I mean, David's exactly right that the Geneva Convention doesn't get into it, because the Geneva Convention is just about, originally, about the behavior of soldiers when they're in a war, regardless of what that war is about. But remember that the United Nations Court, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, has very clear guidelines on wars of aggression and wars of defense. And I mean, within a week of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, it declared it to be illegal and demanded that Russia withdraw immediately. Now, the ICJ has no enforcement mechanism, but there's a clear way in the international world of judging wars and declaring some of them to be wars of aggression, others of them to be more defensible as wars. So it's not that there's nothing there. But you're right, the Geneva Conventions were very pragmatic. They really arose out of a couple of treaties in the 1920s, in 1929, which were then formalized in four Geneva Conventions in 1949. And they were really about soldiers versus soldiers. And it's only since then, in 1977, there were two additional protocols, which were about civilians, non-combatants. So the original Geneva Conventions was really about how uniformed soldiers should react to other uniformed soldiers, the weapons that they should use, the way they should treat them when they become prisoners and so on, which is why in British war films, you know, people are always waving a copy of the Geneva Convention. It was all about soldiers. 1977, because of the changes in the nature of warfare, the Geneva Conventions were extended to the protection of civilians in war, the illegality of collective punishment, making civilians somehow responsible for things that have happened in their territories and so on. And so the additional protocols are very extensive. Again, there's no great enforcement mechanism, but it is all part of that development of international law that David was talking about.
If we look at particularly the role of the Geneva Conventions to protect civilians, I mean, the ICRC president this week was asked if she thought they would be able to mark the 100th anniversary, how concerned she was that, and she's very concerned. You know, the ICRC is recording more than 120 conflicts in the world right now. Back in 1999, for the 50th anniversary, they were recording 20, and we see repeatedly very clear violations of the Geneva Convention principles and seemingly no comeback.
No, I mean, that's right, because we're entering into a world of much greater disorder than the one that you and I were brought up in for most of our lives. And so as conflict becomes fractured, as more things become conflictual, as it becomes harder to distinguish between international conflict and domestic conflict or civil war, domestic instability, all of those things are now all of a piece. And we are moving into this world, which is becoming a contest among autocrats and gangsters with the liberal democracies, as it were, who were dominant, now very much on the back foot, very much on the defensive, trying somehow to exert some influence over this. But that very bleak picture, which is getting bleaker all the time, doesn't invalidate the fact that there is still a core of principles as to what law should be and what human how human affairs should be governed and how international law should be interpreted. And what's interesting, you know, is that even in the midst of all this depressing news, people still talk about international law. They would still rather be on the side of international law than against it. And it's always a problem that there's no enforcement mechanism unless there is a powerful hegemonic power or group of powers. Now, the enforcement mechanism after the Second World War was a United States-led alliance, and that enforced quite a lot of this stuff. That's now very much on the back foot. If the autocracies, as it were, win the contest that we're in the middle of now by the 2030s, then they will be the enforcement mechanism. But my guess is that they won't really enforce the Geneva Conventions very strongly.
Okay, finally this week, the moment that made me. It comes from a decorated veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. Kim Hughes was a high-threat bomb disposal operator, awarded the George Cross after a tour of Afghanistan in which he safely disarmed more than 100 improvised bombs. But his career started very differently, as a driver in the Royal Logistic Corps. After 2 years, in 1999, when he felt he was drifting aimlessly, he was deployed to Northern Ireland, separated from the rest of his squadron, to be the driver for a bomb disposal team.
To be honest, I was initially disheartened because I wouldn't be hanging around with the guys, wouldn't be going out on the ground with those with the teams there and doing what they were doing. So initially, yeah, I wasn't over the moon. But then when I interacted with the bomb disposal teams, in the early sort of stages of that deployment, I found it was completely the opposite. I was essentially with the core kit.
It's a year after the Good Friday Agreement. What was it like? Because it wasn't trouble-free at that point.
We were exceptionally busy. Every day we were out on the grounds responding to suspect devices, confirmed improvised explosive devices. And it was 6 months solid of being out and about.
And the light bulb moment, the moment that made you, what happened?
Yeah, so it was, again, one of my first deployments out onto the ground in West Belfast. It was almost like being thrown in the deep end. And I was just a driver. I essentially drove the team from A to B. And it was only really when the bomb disposal operator put this big bomb disposal suit on and essentially just walked down the road to an improvised explosive device. I was sort of dumbfounded and didn't really know what he was doing. And then the more questions I asked, the more information and figuring out that this guy was putting his life on the line to return the situation to normal in West Belfast at that time, just absolutely shocked me. And it shocked me into the point where I wanted to be that guy and I wanted to put that bomb disposal suit on and step away from my career as a driver and essentially go after the ammunition technician's course.
What was it about seeing that made you think that's what I want?
It was, I think it was a mixture of everything. I think although I'd only been a driver for a couple of years at that point, I didn't really see my career going any further than driving big army green trucks up and down the M1, A1M. And I think it was a mixture of understanding what this individual was doing, understanding how improvised explosive devices work. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to take fireworks apart and figure all that sort of stuff out. And it just intrigued me. And knowing that there was something else beyond driving big army green trucks and to learn about, you know, the chemistry behind explosives and why terrorist organizations do what they do and all that sort of jazz, it absolutely intrigued me.
It's interesting you say you were fascinated with fireworks as a kid. And I think you wrote in your memoir that you kind of stood there, saw it and thought, I could be a soldier and play around with explosives.
Yeah, it was just, it sort of all came together to be able to do that. And you know, there's nothing quite like it, to be honest. It's great work.
So at that moment, you knew what you wanted to be, but you still had to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not something that you can just do overnight. I mean, there's loads of assessments, selection processes, psychometric evaluations to even be considered to be put forward for the training. And then once you jump through all those hoops, you're back in the classroom for the better part of, you know, 6-7 months, back in school, learning everything there is to know about ammunition. I mean, you do the ammunition part before you get anywhere near any kind of bomb disposal part. And it's essentially back in the classroom, learning how missiles work, grenades work, artillery systems work, ammunition storage, ammunition handling, all of that just so that you can be an ammunition technician by trade. And then from that point on, you then go out into the wider world and learn the trade. And then if you're lucky and fortunate enough, you can move into the sort of bomb disposal world.
I think the first half of your training, 10 out of 30 got to go on. So you were part of the minority, and yet you always saw yourself as someone who struggled with school, who struggled with learning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wholeheartedly hold my hand up to the fact that I did struggle with reading and writing and whatnot. And I did struggle when I went back on the course. You know, I consider myself to be more of a practical individual rather than, you know, sitting in a classroom. And it was difficult. And I had to teach myself, you know, maths. I had to teach myself physics and all that sort of jazz, and was helped massively throughout that process.
How then did you get through it? Had something in you changed?
Yeah, I think it was because I wanted it more than anything I've ever wanted. You know, I wanted to be that guy that put the bomb disposal suit on, the guy that was solving the problems for the police and assisting, whether it be in Northern Ireland or wherever it may be. And I found when I was a driver, I didn't really necessarily have that sort of personal drive to be better. And it's only when I saw that individual in a bomb disposal suit that made me realize there was other stuff out there I could be getting after.
So from the start of your training, how long was it before you were out on the ground dealing with bombs?
So as I said previously, to even get considered to do any kind of bomb disposal in the improvised sense, you have to be an ammunition technician by trade. You have to go out there into the wider world and learn your trade. And I was only a Lance Corporal by the time I passed my training. So I had a couple of years before I could come back on what is known as an upgrading course, which will then allow me to do my bomb disposal course. So yes, I was out and about. I did various tours of Northern Ireland. I went back to Northern Ireland and into Bosnia. I went to Iraq, where I was doing conventional munitions disposal, so destroying conventional munitions, hand grenades, artillery shells, blind ammunition natures that have failed on the range, all that sort of stuff. But the improvised explosive device piece, as an operator, as the guy that puts the bomb disposal suits on, it probably took me about 7 years to get to where I needed to be to do that.
And what a career from there. When you reflect on everything you did in Iraq and Afghanistan, earning yourself a George Cross for the more than 100 IEDs you disposed of, does it all hinge on that moment?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I wouldn't have become an instructor at our bomb disposal school. I wouldn't have made the relationships I've made, made the friends I've made, past the high threat bomb disposal course deployed, if I hadn't have had that moment in Northern Ireland. I mean, where would I have been now? Absolutely no idea. Probably driving for Esso or something like that, I would assume.
What kind of person do you think all that experience has made you?
I'd like to say older and wiser. It certainly made me appreciative of effort that is required to get where you want to be in your career, in your life. It's made me more patient, within reason. Certainly when recovering from deployments in the likes of Afghanistan, you know, when it's the classic whole army hurry up and wait. Yeah, an appreciation for patience. So yeah, it's good. And being a person that's able to pass on that information and pass on that training and that knowledge has certainly pushed away for me.
Kim, it is quite an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
No, thank you for having me.
Talking to Kim after what we've been discussing with the Geneva Conventions, Mike, I mean, it strikes me he is one of many people in the armed forces who do jobs that are entirely focused on reducing threats and protecting lives.
Yes. And I remember David Richards, I once asked him when he was chief of the general staff, I said, you know, being a soldier, did that ever cause you any moral doubts? And he said, no, he said, because I know that my actions occasionally save people's lives. And I was pretty proud of that. And I think that's absolutely right. But what's interesting about, you know, Kim's story, in a way, is one of those people, a bit like being a combat pilot. Their job is to go into extremely dangerous situations for a short period and then go back to all the home comforts in the evening, go back to their families, go back to the mess. It's not as if they're on the front line all the time. It's a very strange sort of dichotomy between great danger and then an ordinary life within an hour. And I think that does have a, you know, psychological price that people pay. You know, there's a famous joke about UXO, you know, the bomb disposal squad. Mm. They always say, if you ever see a member of the bomb disposal squad running, it's as well to try to keep up with them.
Or possibly run in the opposite direction. It depends whether they're incoming or outgoing, doesn't
it? Absolutely, yeah.
Mike, thank you so much. Good to see you again. That is all for now. Thank you to all of our guests. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest on our website. That's forcesnews.com. From now, though, from me, James Hurst, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.